Good. Well, sorry. Start over again a little bit. Welcome, everybody. We've got Paul on the phone. Sort of go through the list of names who's here, including Kevin and Dave. But as I looked at Laura, I realized I did not bring any cookies.
Wait, that's terrible.
What? It's terrible.
We're on the record. No,
on the record now. Yes, there we go. So
I realized there were no cookies.
I have not eaten cookies for like a while.
I know. And so you were counting on this morning,
probably,
and I let you down.
Minutes.
I apologize. Anyway, so just Paul, Don's not here, and I haven't heard from anybody else. So good. A few announcements before we jump in. First, I wanted to welcome Nate, who's our newest staff member, and I'll let Nate introduce himself a little bit about where he's coming from and his background.
Thank you. My name's Nate Winstrup. I had a law school. I practiced for 3 or 4 years with the Public Defender's Office in the Bronx in state court. In the last 2.5 years, I've been with the Federal Defender in Montgomery, Alabama. So we're very excited to be here and working with you all in D.C. It's a little bit of a change from Alabama, but welcome at the end of the summer.
So Nate and his family just recently moved to D.C., and we're really, really happy to have him on board. Other matters. I sent out an email in August with some meeting dates for the coming year, just to get it on everybody's calendar, and I didn't hear any objections, so those are... Please calendar those. Put a copy up on the screen again. But like, basically, it's sticking with the same pattern. First Wednesday of the month, except New Year's is obviously going to be a conflict. So we moved it there to the second Wednesday of the month in January. But, you know, I would also just say, obviously, this coming year, especially spring, summer, going to be more kind of excitement as we're trying to push out recommendations, and so this is kind of a default schedule, but my guess is additional meetings may very well be added in towards the end, and as the schedule gets a little less uniform and regimented. Our next meeting is Wednesday, October 2nd. Between now and then, the reports we'll talk about today, there's the controlled substance offenses. Written comments are due on the 16th, Monday the 16th, and for weapon offenses, Monday, September 30th. So some time on both of those. Staff's available if anybody wants to kind of have a side meeting and to discuss matters as you're thinking things through and formulating your comments. Just let us know so we can try to, schedule something.
And 38's due the same time as 37?
Right. So 37, 38, 23, that cluster. 9-16, the other cluster, including self-defense phrase, on 9-30. If there's no questions on schedule or any other announcements... let's jump in, and I actually want to reverse the order a bit, given the due dates, and start with controlled substances and see if there are comments or questions you all have on reports 37-38. And hopefully, again, people got a good start on that, even with August being August. Any questions or comments for the whole group at this point?
This is usually when people reach for the cookies. There aren't any.
You know, look, I mean, honestly, obviously the big change here throughout, the single biggest one is grading based on weight, right? Which the district, unlike almost every jurisdiction, has not done historically. We thought about some alternatives, and you know, this is just the direction that other jurisdictions have gone. It's the kind of clear way for grading, but it raises a lot of line drawing issues as to what particular weights should be involved for distribution and tracking, right? So Janu did a lot of looking at other jurisdictions, those which, you know, while often maybe very detailed in, you know, obviously in the federal statutes, very detailed in their sentencing guidelines, finding an amount of detail that breaks things out by the kind of distinctions we have already in law as to what constitutes a controlled substance or is hard. So he, put this together, and we are very open to, I would say, particular changes to the weights, right? Again, this is a line drawing exercise. We tried to look at other jurisdictions and do this in a thoughtful way, but any particular differences, you all have access to perhaps, in-house experts that you work with who might have, opinions about this kind of thing, and making sure that, 100 grams of whatever is similar in nature to 200 grams of this other thing in terms of the number of effective doses or something like this, which so as a grading matter, we just want to make sure that these are approximately accurate in their how proportionate they are to each other.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
You started with weight, and I don't mean to yeah. move it a little.
Sure.
But I want to back it up just one step before we get to weight. So we have first degree, and then we have, which is the in fact for possession, and then we have the weights associated with the first degrees. But how are those drugs chosen? In other words, a lot of those are Schedule II drugs as opposed to D.C. Schedule I drugs, which under D.C. law would have no effective use. I'm wondering why we start with Schedule II as opposed to Schedule I, and then I can comment on weights.
Sure.
The specific drugs that we have listed here?
Yeah.
And we just took those from the current definition of abusive and narcotic drugs.
But those are, at least two or three of them are Schedule IIs, and I was wondering why there's no kicker for a Schedule I drug. And I'm talking D.C. Schedule I, not federal, because I don't want to get into marijuana and stuff. But the Schedule I's have no useful purpose. Mm-hmm. Schedule II, by definition, have some useful purpose. And I was just wondering why.
Yeah, I mean, again, we just took this list from the current definitions of abusive and narcotic. Now, again, this might be an area where someone with some better specific expertise might say, actually, this drug, which is currently defined as a narcotic or abusive drug, actually isn't so harmful and maybe should not be included. Weights aside, if there's like a substance in here that perhaps should not be included.
No, I was thinking of there are others that I think are even more dangerous than these that are on Schedule I. And in fact, the ways the schedules are defined would make you believe that. That is a difference between Schedule I. And Schedule II. And I'm not saying I'm pushing for them. I'm just wondering why Schedule I's aren't included.
Sure. So Schedule I, so I have, on the screen, so I don't know why we're getting that little blue sort of filter. That's lovely. So I'll see if I can deal with that. But right, I mean, this, we were going straight off of where penalties are set in current law, which is one or Schedule 1 or 2, that is a controlled narcotic or abusive drug, right? So that's just what we were tracking. Now, again, if you have different considerations about, right, and should, why did, I don't know offhand in terms of legislative history.
I mean, this, these are certainly the popular drugs,
mm-hmm.
but I'm not sure that should be the reason for...
Mm-hmm. Right. So our baseline for this list was going off of current penalties. Now, again, why Schedule 1 the way it is? Those are, that's, you know, that's a mayoral judgment, although heavily
it's
informed
mostly by,
Congress,
by the council. There's only a couple of times the mayor actually used his or her authority.
Right, so, you know, this thing, this could be, either way, right, how the schedules,
yeah.
The schedules, to my knowledge, there is, unless you all at an agency level have some sort of review that feeds into the council or the mayor, I don't know that they are ever reviewed on a regular basis, right, or frankly have ever been reviewed since
yeah, there's a couple of times where we've added to it by legislation.
When there are particular...
We did that recently.
Which is like identified all the, yeah, all the analogs.
You know, sure. Those kind of things.
But, as part of that process, was there consideration of the whole list, though, or was it simply, look, we have a new particular thing, right? And we want to see that that's accounted for. So yeah, to my knowledge, again, since the lists were initially created, they haven't been revisited except, oh, we're going to take marijuana out here, we're going to like add in analogs here, you know. So, you know, look, right. This basically takes forward into law those distinctions in categories. And if they are inept for some reason, you know, let us know. I will say, you know, Janu can kind of maybe speak to this a bit more, but like, again, these categories, how other jurisdictions handle these, it's quite various. There's a lot of difference, and this is why it's very hard to summarize, you know, how the grading works for in terms of weight, for the penalties, for any particular drug, because the categories used, the little subcategories of which controlled substances are kind of treated with greater seriousness, it really varies across jurisdictions. So, and I don't know, and again, this is like one of those cases too, where I think even if you had the incredibly detailed spreadsheet listing all of the ways different jurisdictions break out for particular drugs, and maybe from that you could glean a plurality seem to go this way with respect to this drug at this, you know, at the highest level, I suspect that, like our jurisdiction, many of these others simply have not reevaluated that in any systematic way for many years. So I guess I would say approach this with a like clean.
No, that's fine. I mean, you answer. Yeah. I don't know how my memo is going to go.
Sure. Yet,
but I was just curious to what the thinking is.
You bet. That was
so another thing that we had a little sidebar on. So if it says not more than 100 grams of phencyclidine, and you have phencyclidine sprayed on marijuana or on some green plant material, what are we weighing?
So you'd weigh the whole thing. So cause we considered, and this is just the general rule.
Yeah,
you have cut,
to make
right,
sure
and cut drug,
was,
you know.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think you just have to weigh the entirety of the cigarette or the marijuana, and then if it all contains phencyclidine, that would be the relevant weight. We toyed around with trying to say X grams of pure drug X, and I think that would be too difficult.
And the reason I ask, in addition to sidebars, is you did away with the liquid PCP. So like liquid PCP, which was a 3-year or whatever, three-year misdemeanor, right? It was liquid, I would assume, is pure. Than spraying it on, I don't know, on green matter.
Yeah, I mean, again, purity, there was no purity measure at all in the current law, right? And so, and part of our thought in doing this is just something that is compatible with current lab practices as best as we understand them, right? Which is to say, the weight of the material at issue is taken by purity measurements.
Yeah.
You know, that would be a whole new.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm not proposing it. I'm just clarifying.
Yeah, I think any state does it. Every state that we looked at does this current rule where it's the mixture is the relevant quantity.
I think this will be kind of in our comments, but I think clarifying for everything that there can be proof of a compound or mixture containing the controlled substance instead of actually requiring proof of the controlled substance, because it appears in both forms throughout it kind of differently, and I think that might eliminate the need for purity testing, which I think would be an additional burden and is not required under current law, but clarifying that it could be a compound or mixture containing the controlled substance, I think would be.
Okay, so without regard to what current law is, because this is, of course, reform, so I have a question about this as well,
yes.
And that is, what is a compound, a mixture, or whatever, right? So what has troubled me are stories that I've heard, and I notice that this is sort of in fact, where it's an undercover police officer, somebody who's clearly working with law enforcement, who says, hey, why don't you mix it in with this, you know, 5-pound bag of flour? And it is completely at the suggestion of law enforcement to jack up the penalties. And that concerns me. I mean, if it is, here, put it into this coffee can, where it's clear, you know, where it's not even going to sort of mix in it or spray it all over, you know, a carton of cigarettes, that seems really wrong. And I'm curious what if it doesn't mix in? Like, what is a mixture? Is there some way where at least, is that already defined in some place so that if it's clearly, it's like transported that way as opposed to could be consumed that way, right? Like, the way you're going to sneak it in is to hide it in the coffee can, even though, like, you'll never get it out, but that's not the point, because really we just are going to arrest you in a second.
Yeah, I mean, it does create these bizarre issues, like even in the cigarette hypo, like we thought, what if someone has, like, dippers
yeah.
on PCP, and again, I think we have to weigh the entire tobacco that's been, but what if a little bit of the PCP soaks through to the cardboard box? Does the cardboard box now count as, like, a mixture? And
yeah, good point. Well, you're probably not smoking the cardboard box, or whatever one does.
Or all the dollar bills in our pockets, right? You know, that have a trace amount of something that is detectable from a lab test. Is that, like, there's no case law on
yeah.
this. There are no, we didn't find any, there was nothing in other jurisdictions that statutorily addresses this.
And there are bizarre cases, bizarre cases from other jurisdictions where it's like bong water and it was found to have trace amounts of THC, and they said, well, this is a mixture that contains some trace amounts of THC, so we weigh like the whole amount of water. So there are sort of bizarre cases at the margins. But we're sort of thinking of like cut heroin, cut cocaine, adulterated substances. But yeah, as far as like marginal cases, should the coffee can count as part of the weight of the mixture, or even if it's mixed partially, are there some, you know, is there some material that doesn't contain any heroin, for example?
I know that the goal of this is to not overly rely on prosecutorial discretion, but I do think that at some point, you know, we might say, well, that's pretty silly, why would we ever go forward? I understand that the exercise is not to rely on discretion, but I do think that it can also be accounted for, certainly.
Just so I know current practice, if it's very helpful. So let's say through the investigation, you know as a matter of fact, they obtain a 5-milligram fentanyl and they lace that with an eighth of an ounce of marijuana. You know that was the recipe. Are you charging them for both or the 5 milligrams?
I'm going to be honest, I actually
know
very little about our drug practices and drug laws in general.
If there's a situation in which it is known what the precursors were that meant to the mix, it feels strange to me to be on the hook for prosecution because it was mixed with 10 pounds of whatever other thing happens there. That's just not the...
Yeah.
I think the amount of the substance is the core harm and not the solution it ends right. up
I mean,
in.
In practice, I mean, once again, this is not my specialty at all, and I'm sorry, I don't know much about this. But it's my understanding that very few drugs would be found in their pure forms on the streets. And so, I mean, how would you extract, you know, cocaine from baking soda or whatever it might be mixed with to ascertain how much cocaine there is.
Well, it'd be in, like in Laura's case. So if it's an undercover operation and it's literally observed what the mixture was going into it, I feel very comfortable saying the law should foreclose being on the hook for the full amount. Except, I mean, because then the separate hook is you'd be on the hook for the distribution of each offense. So to the extent you dilute the supply and then you create a larger supply that way, I think the law can accurately and appropriately target that behavior through the distribution prong. So you have the core harm. Possession is based on the amount of the substance and the substance itself. Distribution is based on the fact that you're now introducing that to other people. And I think the amount of supply as it relates to the entire solution and not just the mixture should feed into the distribution offense, not so much the possession offense. That's just my initial...
But it is.
That's what I'm saying. So I'm pointing this out as a problem.
Yeah,
yeah, and it's well taken. I mean, the idea that like 100 grams of pure heroin is different than 100 grams of a mixture that's a quarter heroin or something.
I don't even want to state it in purity, because that's like, goes like you can have bad purity through the manufacture of the heroin itself, so you can take 80% heroin and mix that into other things.
Sure.
It's when what you're mixing it in is a perfectly fine substance, and then that's being used to raise the net weight. I mean, it's like the pot brownie cases that you see.
I mean, honestly, like, probably... love to brainstorm. We can look at... I don't know that there are any models out there for jurisdictions that have, by statute, kind of handled this. I do think that... I suspect that, like, tobacco and marijuana are probably the two substances most frequently, like, to just, again, take care of the majority of cases where this is going to happen, where they are mixed with some other controlled substance and then consumed.
Or PCP, or which is typically sprayed on something.
On one of those.
But that's how it's absorbed, that's right.
Right. So, I guess, what is the base marijuana... semi-legal or legal substance, yeah. Right? And to discount that is what I kind of hear. Like, that might, if we could address that in some way, that might take care of the bulk of these cases. Not all the cases where there's a mixture and your broader question about this. But it would, like, the biggest practical slice of stuff is where I think something is being smoked and the base legal matter is marijuana or tobacco.
Well, in some cases, it's also just like cocaine and heroin. Like, I don't think it's going to be pure. I think typically it's cut with some sort of adulterant, which is otherwise legal.
But think about like a definition for mixture. Like, you're only weighing the thing you can consume.
I think
we could start with that. Well,
I just think if you can't consume it, I don't think people should be weighing it. It's like weighing the flower pot that has a plant growing in it. If you can't consume it, I don't think you should be weighing it. On the other hand, if it's PCP sprayed on marijuana, I think you should be weighing the PCP sprayed on marijuana.
The sprays are the hardest ones to figure out how to weigh.
Right. It's going to be a very slight amount.
How do you subtract out the cigarette from the...
And that's why I'm saying, I think, but under current law, that is what you do, right?
Under current law, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah. It would be the PCP sprayed on whatever substance is what you're...
So they would charge you with both, right? Like, if you sprayed PCP onto marijuana, you would get a charge for the PCP and the marijuana. If you sprayed K2 on marshmallow leaf or Damiana or something like that, the weight doesn't matter. They're just testing to see if that chemical is present or not.
I'm not sure who's charging that. When we used to charge PCP sprayed on marijuana, we only charged the marijuana when there was a question about the PCP.
Right, and we don't realize it was the PCP. Even the prosecution. Yeah. I think generally, if you possess a bag of heroin and a bag of cocaine together, it could be brought as two separate charges.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
And so I think it's the same thing if they happen to be sprayed on one another. Yeah, but it's the point of mixtures again. Like,
but
you
I agree
have
with
models
the
for purity testing.
Point.
Mm-hmm. But your point is that if I have 100 grams of 50 grams of heroin mixed with 50 grams of some kind of adulterant, that really the relevant quantity should be just that 50 grams of the pure actual heroin, or is
in
it
in my most ideal world? But that
I don't know that we could.
But
how
I'm not
you
sure we're moving
that,
towards
you.
Yeah,
right, so, but I guess I would be more concerned about, right, so the bong water or it soaks on the cardboard or something,
mm-hmm.
No friggin' way. And then I guess I want, you know, some room for a thing. I don't know. I'm thinking this up now because you had such a long pause there and it gave me time to think.
Awkward.
That's why you paused for so long, so we'd start talking. Is some ability to defend against, I wasn't gonna spray it on a carton of cigarettes. I was going to spray it on three cigarettes. But the undercover officer's like, you know, my people like it really diluted, so how about a carton or whatever, right? That, like, not, I do know in the end, or it would be, in fact, on a carton, but that's not what I was going to do. I basically was entrapped into that. And I don't even feel like that ends up, it doesn't, the way I read it, that wouldn't even be, I don't know what we're doing with entrapment. We haven't done defenses yet, but assuming that still exists, that doesn't even work as a defense to how I understand this to be read. I'd still be knowingly distributing, in fact, what turned out to be 200 grams or whatever because I sprayed it on so many cigarettes.
I mean, that
seems wrong
that's
to me.
Issue, though, even if we had some kind of purity test, if the officer just said, actually, I want to buy 200 grams of pure heroin, I mean, it seems like it's similarly... I don't know if we're actually satisfied.
Right, that's true. That is true. Yes, uh-huh. That would. But at least I would know I was doing that much of the drug, right? I'd be like, "Ooh, I'm big time now. I've got an order for it." But like, I was doing that much versus
just adding an
adulterate. Versus like, I'm still my little small town dealer, but somebody put me right over small time dealer put me over some limit to something really serious because. Of
just by adding an adulterant.
Of completely, you know, put it in a whole lot of brownies. Put it you know, that just seems
I mean, I
wrong.
Think, I don't know how the entrapment defense will look, but I think, like, the more difficult hypothetical might even be if you have two substances that are both controlled, right? And there's insistence that you mix them together. And so now you have a pound of heroin and a pound of cocaine when really you had, like, a half pound of each.
Right.
But what's going to matter is where those levels are set, right? Whatever that threshold quantity should reflect, you know, like, not just maybe dosage, but, like, the frequency that you all see in court or the frequency that your drug experts say is consistent with however many dosages. But eventually a line's going to have to be drawn somewhere that takes all of those things into account. But, I mean, even under current law, if you get arrested for having cocaine and then the DEA-7 comes back and it says, oh, there's cocaine and a trace of heroin, they'll add a heroin charge, right? Like, so if the weight counts, it's going to count for both of them since they're mixed together. Does that make sense?
Something to think about. I also wonder if, like, again, this is more of a... So maybe there's something we can do in defining mixture to, again... exclude non-consumables, right? Like, as a base level, sounds like that, you know, seems a reasonable thing. Beyond that, it gets really hard without doing additional lab tests as to particular quantities or purity. And I think, you know, again, most jurisdictions don't do this. We can look a bit more into, like, how some other jurisdictions do handle some problems like this. But I also think, like, something on the back end in terms of, you know, maybe it's a merger provision or something about, you know, the half pound and a half pound making a pound, great, charge it, go with both under a pound, whichever the two controlled substances, but those convictions would, the penalties would merge. With and keep whatever the most serious is for that quantity, right? Like, that would help to address some of the issue here. Welcome other innovation on this. I mean, again, like, the statutes are pretty straightforward in other jurisdictions that we've kind of gone this way. They don't get into purity, and you can imagine the lab.
I was going to say,
difficulties of going down that road.
It might be helpful to just get a sense of DFS capabilities in this area, because if they say, yeah, like, GCMS totally gives us a complete breakdown of different weights, and so it's actually not a problem at all, and then that... I mean, I'm assuming there are some difficulties in testing, but I am not a scientist, so they could say, actually, it's we can do this with some relative reliability, and then that could just inform how we sort of structure a rule around it.
Sure.
Or it could be, I mean, because DFS is an institutional party to litigation, we can, it's outside the criminal system, but there can be things about how DFS does testing and drug prosecutions to sort of address some of these concerns too. So it could be that it's outside the four corners of substantive criminal law, but if it's relevant. I can try to reach out to them and see if I can get some guidance.
Yeah, I think a general question of like, is this a kind of a, would testing for purity and these issues be a mind-blowingly totally, you know, new regime and beyond the current capabilities, or is it actually something that is kind of latent? It's actually, we just don't report it out. We routinely, in fact, test for that, but it's not part of what we report. Maybe there is something in their practice that would really...
The purity's always on the reports. Like, even now, even though weight doesn't matter, every time you get a DEA 7, it has the purity level listed on it.
I guess the question is, to what extent are they going at the mixture, though, to really identify what the relevant components are by weight or volume?
I mean, to get any purity number, though, they're going to have some calculations for this, right?
Yeah.
As to, like, dividing weight and mixtures, and so I...
But
how reliable those are, you know, like again.
And does it vary with the weight? Are you testing something that is, that's consumable so that you use it up and you can say specifically what it is versus a half a pound of something? Do you have to test all half pound to get what it is?
Yeah, and like,
I mean, that's where I thought the hurdle is. If it's suspended
in layers or something, it starts getting tricky.
Especially the larger the amount. But I have no problem with people asking.
I mean, it does seem like edibles are the real problem because the non-consumable isn't going to be excluded from that. But you can have edible PCP and have a cake. It's easy to get to 200 grams of cake. That's going to be
placed with
PCP. Yeah. So then how, if you had a rule that how do those other jurisdictions deal with edibles?
I don't think they explicitly. They just use this compound or mixture language. I didn't specifically research
and
how
those
edibles.
Definitions are pretty much standard. Like
the compound or mixture language. Didn't just look at research specifically about like a cake or an edible. My guess would be that they just weigh the whole brownie or the whole.
There was a brownie one, right?
I was going to say you could. If you define a mixture in such a way that it's literally based on the lab's capabilities, so to the extent the lab is able to actually separate and identify different compounds, and then it's just incumbent on the, like, that's what you use in the prosecution then. So you could,
that
like.
It's tricky because they would have to, like, test every single thing.
Right,
and they
have
to
cake. Yeah, you can't just take one slice.
Well, that's the thing, though, but if it's. So I don't know. It could be in a couple cases. And so you have the one where it's a liquid, and let's say you can actually parse out, oh, it's 90% water, 10% X. So that in that case, it would be a compound or mixture that they can identify relevant precursors to and then charge accordingly. If it's like the marijuana in a coffee can or something, and then it's just all mixed up, and you'd have to like make sure it's all uniformly distributed, then take a sample out and then test it that way. Mm-hmm. Perhaps that's just simply not a mixture or compound that DFS can identify the precursors for. And then so that I don't love the fact that based on how you mix it, you're on the hook for the full weight of prosecution, because that whether I mix it with a solid versus a liquid then affects my liability in ways that I don't really think bear on culpability. But I'm sort of just throwing the kitchen sink out there because I do think it raises some problems.
I will also, you know, we will this fall be putting out, you know, what we've been able to get from the court in terms of updated, you know, statistics. We hope to have a 10-year span up through 2018. 2009 through 2018. And, you know, I will say again, like, just based on, you know, our reviews so far, you know, look, in the end, the penalties coming out of the court for drug offenses of whatever weight and trafficking of whatever weight are very low by most national standards, shall we say. out of Superior Court. You know, while right now we have on the books an undifferentiated trafficking any amount, quid any amount, 30-year max, and we are trying to be more proportionate in the grading, you know, even under the current statute, don't quote me on that, you know, but I believe it's there aren't penalties greater than 5 years, right? So like the compression that we're talking about, right, between reality and practice, based on what fact finders in DC think about this, and what's on the books is really huge right now. So if we can take 3-4 steps in bringing and creating gradations and bringing what's on the books closer to current practice and current norms in the district, that would be good. So all that's to say, I don't want the perfect to be the enemy of the good in this place, and that on all of this, I think penalties, our recommendations will be shifting them down significantly. It doesn't negate the concerns about, right, you know, hey, in this case, a mixture, or in this kind of, you know, sting operation, whatever, and trap, like, you know, it could lead to unjust results. I don't mean to diminish that, but I also think, like, you know, we're no longer talking about the difference between, you know, 30, you know, like, what's on the books just is a bit of a fiction, and has been for some time. So.
Okay, this is Paul.
Yes.
What we are talking about, though, is basically micro law enforcement. If you look at our old agency, the Citizen Commission, and you look at their racial disparities, they are colored that, but their evidence about the kind of racial breakdown and who gets charged with crime, especially for drug crimes, white people don't get charged with drug crimes in D.C. by and large. And so we're talking about things like stings and undercover operations. Those are exclusively directed at African-American people. So that's also something that we need to keep in mind as we have this discussion about the appropriate penalties.
Yes. The statistics that we have this time around from the court will include demographic information about race to the extent it's collected. There's an awful lot of unknowns and an awful lot of there are real quality issues in the data that is there, but also gender. So we will be, the statistics we kind of put forward for your consideration along as we talk about penalties will include that information. Absolutely.
I read this. I read it a couple weeks ago or whenever. I don't remember, and if you haven't done it, then I suggest tackling it, sort of where the numbers come from. I feel like this is going to be a chapter that is going to keep getting added. Just like drugs is complicated, and the chemicals, and like it's just been mucked around with. I feel like more than other chapters recently, I mean, but for guns because of Heller stuff, and that it's going to be the hard one, I think, for the council when there's a new drug that they've got to figure out, like, how do I go about thinking about what the weight should be? And some of that will be very tied to the conversation we just had, right? Some of the what you want the weight to be will matter about, well, how is that drug delivered or whatever? Is it always mixed with something? Do we, but even if it's just how, what sorts of questions you were thinking of or answering when you were coming up with it, so that when someone has to grapple with a new drug or whatever, they at least, there's some consistency, right? That there's some, you know, it's sort of where we went with sentencing commission of like, all right, the way we're going to start in terms of what group we're putting it in is what's the maximum penalty, right? That we had to sort of learn how to start putting in new information into our old system. But we started doing that because we kind of knew how we built the system in the first place. And I feel like that's going to help someone who's got to start plugging new stuff in.
You're talking beyond the definitions of the schedules themselves, right? Because each schedule has its own definition and they vary.
Right, well, there's these weights now. Yeah. That, yeah. Like, none of us has ever, that's not how we think in Superior Court, right? And so there's going to be some new, you know, a new K2 type thing that someone's going to have to make a decision. Is that 50 grams or 500? Where's the line?
I think for me, the way I tend to think about it is I would find the one with the smallest gram as a threshold and then treat all the others as, like, multiples of that. So you have 10 grams of one. So you get to 200 grams, I would say. Mm-hmm. Methamphetamine is a 20x potency of whatever our least one is, and sort of just build an ordinal list of... So I guess it's like, what, potency, method of ingestion, capacity for abuse, and legitimate purposes is kind of like the factors. And then just put them in order. And then at least at that point, it's a question of, you know, where in this ordinal list of potencies do we think it falls based on how it's actually used in the community. But...
Yeah, and those are always going to be generalizations, right? Like, you know, this whole... exercise is one in approximation, right? What is the typical use?
Do we also know how it's typically sold? I mean, I remember in New York in the 70s, when they stiffened the marijuana laws, they made it, instead of, 27.5 grams an ounce, they made it like 25 grams or 24 grams. So if you sold an ounce, you got kicked into the larger sentence. So, you know, if it's sold, then you understand where I'm going?
Yeah, I do. I think...
Because I wouldn't want to do that.
Sure. It's hard to be too careful. This has to be a broad brush thing that lasts through, you know, a decade or two, hopefully at least, of... changing potencies and purities and being how it's packaged on, you know, like these things are going to vary. I think you're right, you know, like it's right to raise that in terms of, again, considerations of practically, like, what is, you cash out these weights of a particular, what is that meaning, right, in reality, kind of in terms of on the street. But that's a shifting thing over time. And so I don't know that we can get too fine grained in those considerations. Well, let me ask, I want to make sure to leave time for some of the weapons, any weapons questions. Is there anything more at this point? I think this is a helpful thing to raise on mixtures. Yes.
One little thing.
Yes.
Relatively little in this section on something else.
Okay. Yeah. I think go for it. Anything more on the mixtures
just
question?
Quick one. Yeah. All right. I'm sorry.
Nope.
I have no problem with, you know, you've got the change from 1,000 feet to 100 feet in a school zone.
Okay.
Right?
Yep.
And I was just wondering why 100? Because when I was looking at this, guns are 300 feet or 100 yards.
Mm-hmm.
And I went on the internet and looked at the average size of a school bus, so it's about 3 school buses away, 100 feet. So... I was wondering why we didn't make drugs and guns the same amount of footage, which I think would be 100 yards or 300 feet, rather than going from 1,000 to 100 feet for drugs and 300 feet for guns. And I was wondering if you guys thought about it in that context, because I think there's both the 100 feet is a little too short for drugs from a school, given the size of the average school bus. You know, picturing how far from the school you would be, but also having people need to know two different distances, I think, becomes confusing. So I think we're going to be recommending that it's going to be a consistent...
Sure. I think the concern there was, well, two things. One, first, recall...
The 1,000's too big, and then,
the 100 feet is from the property, right? So not just the school building, but the school grounds. So, you know, and same thing for a playground, you know, so that depending on how much right surrounding area you have on the grounds, that might be seem very expansive or not. Just that is a baseline for both how it guns and here. It's not just the buildings, it's the grounds.
Yeah.
But secondly, yeah, the differentiation on 100 versus 300 was much more to think about 300 getting closer to, you know, a football field, a city block, something that is somewhat intuitive, and also just, you know, firearms are ranged weapons, right? You know, so wanting to give some, whereas 100 feet from a school gets you, you know, even a half block away, right? Or, you know, if dealing's going on, how likely it is to have been contact with kids at that location on the grounds seems, you know, it's the stream coming to and from. We wanted to give more consideration for firearms that, again, it leads to deliberate or accidental discharge, you know, and yeah, what at that point does more work near schools, but also on the other hand, you know, doesn't end up making a majority of the district.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's right? So that was the tension. I don't think we're disagreeing with the drop at 1,000.
Yeah,
you know? I mean,
yeah. So that was the tension we were playing with, and why we distinguished the two was simply, again, the ranged effect of weapons and the danger that a gun going off, even a few hundred feet, you just travel a long way. So, yeah, that was. And,
okay.
But ultimately, line drawing there too, right? So, you know, 75 feet and 325.
Or
bringing them closer together.
One of the things I liked about the gun one was that 100 yards is something a lot of people can
somewhat intuitive
picture, yeah, because of football, as opposed to other things, mm-hmm, other distances.
Yeah.
And people selling, you know, drugs and guns selling together, having the different footage. In any event, that was the question.
Yeah.
Many arms dealers will make sure they review the refreshed.
Yeah. Any last questions on controlled substances? If not, we'll move on to weapons. Great. Okay. Let me pause for effect again and see if there are questions or comments on weapons, unless somebody wants to jump in right away. I should also, my own bad before moving forward, you know, the other separate report on enlistment of minors and maintaining location to manufacture controlled substances. This was report 38. The recommendation there was to repeal, for various reasons, these two statutory sections. Enlistment of minors, 48904.07, and maintaining a location to manufacture controlled substances, 48904.03A. I guess I can kind of say too, you know, since we issued the report, we realized in some of the court statistics, it shows a handful of charges. You know, we're talking maybe one a year. Charges, not even convictions, you know, less than that. Under another provision very similar to the maintaining location to manufacture controlled substances, it's 48904.02A5. Anyway, it's, you know, there in both weapons and drugs, we really struggled to, again, in a targeted way, address the criminal offenses that are most actually, you know, in practice. In both, there's a ton of other both regulatory and even some criminal, you know, charges that just don't come up. So our goal was to tamper as little as possible with the definitions, right, in both cases, in order to leave these other regimes untouched while we focus on what is in active use. In controlled substances, one of the things that meant we didn't look at, like, what's it called, a registered location, or, you know, right, you know, essentially like pharmacies, right? You know, like there's a whole set of other provisions and criminal offenses that relate to them, some of which are in this 904.02A. It also, though, includes, as we just recently discovered since the report came out, includes a very broad language in 904, so I quickly pull it up here. Okay, so it's on the screen, but basically it says in the A5, it's unlawful for any person knowingly to keep or maintain any store, shop, warehouse, dwelling, building, vehicle, boat, aircraft, or other structure or place which is resorted to by persons using controlled substances in violation of this chapter, or for the in violation of this chapter for the purpose of using these substances, or which is used for keeping or selling them in violation of this chapter. That last prong ends up making this provision, even though it's in this other area that is mainly devoted to pharmacies and whatnot, functionally equivalent. The plain language isn't limited to such places, right? In fact, the plain language, you know, by referring to boats and aircraft, would seem to sweep in everything. This provision in A5 904.02 A5 is kind of practically equivalent to the one that we addressed in the report, which was 48904.07, and is kind of more in the core, drug offenses for general trafficking. So we will address this, I think, in the future. We just recently, so we're not sure where the recommendation will go. It will probably be that this, like the other one, for the same reasons given for deleting, maintaining a location to manufacture controlled substances, be repealed. Again, there have been a handful of charges under this provision and the related 904.07, but very, very few. And again, our position is that, you know, this conduct is primarily already criminalized through accessory liability for, you know, and other, you know, forms. If you're maintaining a place to do this with the intent as required, So just wanted to flag that. We'll address it more going forward. But assuming no other questions on Report 38, sorry, I will then, now for real, move forward to weapons and see if there are any questions. So open it up to anybody.
There's one provision where I think that you guys misinterpreted the statute.
Just one. Excellent.
So I'm on page 124 of the report.
Okay.
22E4-1014, which basically rewrites.
Sorry, I'll catch up to you. Can you say again where you are?
22E-4114.
Civil provisions for licenses of firearm dealers.
That's right.
All right.
And it basically reinterprets 22-45-10.
Okay.
And in 45-10, if I could start there and then
you pull that up
and make sure. Look at paragraph 3 as written, especially where the semicolon is. So it says, no pistol shall be sold, A, if the seller has got reason to believe the purchase is not of sound mind, right? Or is under the age of 21 years. Those were the traditional ones in common law. And then it's a semicolon, and unless the purchaser is personally known to the seller, or shall present clear evidence of his or her identity. And I checked with our legal counsel division. They interpret, because of the semicolon, they interpret that to be actually a separate thing. So you can't sell it to somebody who's got some mental issues. You can't sell it to somebody under 21. And when you sell it, you need to know who you're selling it to, either because you know them or because they showed you proper ID. When you translated it on page 124, you gave the proper ID in B3C only to the one under 21. So you say you can't sell it to somebody not of sound mind, somebody who's prohibited from possessing a firearm, or under 21 years of age unless the purchaser is personally known to the seller and presents clear evidence, which would mean you could sell it to a 13-year-old if you knew them. And so it's our interpretation that that is actually a separate thing and it's not tied to the under 21. There is no way you could sell something, to a gun, to a 15-year-old merely because you know the person or they showed you the right ID. That's a separate factor.
Mm-hmm.
I think I understand your point. I would like to look at it a little bit more closely because the age restriction in the regulations is not 21 across the board. There are, for example, provisions allowing for like a person to transfer a weapon to I need to look at it again to see if it's 18 or if it's under 18, if there's a relationship between the transferor and the transferee. And I just don't want to...
No, that's fine.
There
I'm
to
just
be a conflict,
it.
Right, where it's...
No,
where it's criminalized to transfer it to a person who's 19, but the regulations say that you can under certain circumstances. But the reading that you said makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, but I think that the point of that semicolon was to say, whoever you sell it to, mm-hmm. you need to either know them or know their ID, that it wasn't linked to the age thing, that that was a separate factor.
Well, what I hear you saying actually is a little different, so that while it is true that this requirement that you have to either be personally known or present evidence of identity attaches to each of the prior ones, right? So what it isn't the case that you can't sell to the 15-year-old who you know. In fact, you could. The question is whether the B... You know, the B is an exception for each part of A. In other words,
that's not what our legal counsel said, because that would mean that you could sell a gun to somebody who is not of sound mind.
Because
you know them or they've got a driver's license. And that's why, and the same thing with the under 21, they read that semicolon as splitting that off as a separate prohibitor, not related to the A and B. So look it up and see what you decide.
I suspect this is probably bad drafting.
Yes, I'm agreeing. So, which is why I called him up and said, when I saw that, I said, really? I can sell it to somebody under 21 if I know them or they have an ID? That strike me as right.
That's right.
Because we prosecute juveniles and we always say, you know, if you, kids can't legally own a gun. How could they legally own a gun if they have an ID? That doesn't sound right.
It seems like maybe it makes sense to have a D and C would be under 21. I haven't thought about this before, but then D could be unless the purchaser is personally known and prevents clear evidence. But it seems like all those first three categories you just blankly can't sell to them, right? But then D would be or you have to have an ID.
I think the grammar here is severely challenged, and I think as a policy matter, you know, you don't want the crazy guy who I happen to know.
Oh, I know, or who shows me his ID.
That's right. So
what is identity? Is it just name in this context then?
Yeah,
no. I would, because when I think identity, that in my mind is name and age, because that's how you...
Yeah, so we will examine this.
Yeah,
I think
please.
This is one of those places where, like, I suspect, look, you know, Patrice is amazing for, how to put this now. You know, the council has done a tremendous amount of work over the years trying to, you know, keep updating as, you know, in response to litigation, these
the statutes. Engine in the Tercel.
But that's right. That's so much churning has gone on over time.
Yeah, yeah.
And it hasn't always been some provisions like this, some of these civil provisions haven't always in particular been the most thoroughly reviewed. So I think, look, by and large, especially on the civil provisions, we were not aiming to touch them, right? Our aim was to kind of clarify and tease apart and clarify at least what is criminal versus civil. But there are a lot of ambiguities about identity and other places that honestly we are just, we had to kind of choose our battles on this. But like identity, I mean, that's a great issue. Once we go down that slope of identifying it here, then it's like, okay, really, then there's all these other statutes. Like, the work on this could go on for a while, and, you know, unless the council wants to extend us, we aren't going to be hitting that anytime soon. So,
yeah, which is why I so this yeah, one in particular.
This narrow one, I agree. This narrow point we should address. It's a substantive one, and why not take care of this? I think we shouldn't probably defer too much to the drafting here, and should instead just think about what is the
which is where my argument actually comes from. You shouldn't be selling it to people with mental issues. You shouldn't be selling it to children, yeah. And anyone you sell it to, you should know who you're selling it to, either because I know him, or if I don't know him and exactly who he is, he's got to identify himself so we know who he's to.
We have other statutes that specifically address false information in purchasing. Right? So we'll take a look at this, and I do...
Well, not of sound mind, you may be able to...
But unless you're visually delusional at the time of purchase, your identity is a critical precursor to me understanding if you're, like... I don't know. In that mind, that goes down to like...
So as a practical matter, you're only allowed to sell a weapon if you're a licensed seller.
That's right, correct.
Unless you're like selling it to your kid or something like that. And so the licensed sellers have to follow all these protocol, and their identity would include name, address, you know... Like
relevant background.
All kinds of information. So I don't think that there's a gap there, but it would be helpful for me... in your comments to include what you think identity means, because you said, for example, name and age, and my intuition would have been name and address, so it would be helpful to see how you think it's supposed to be defined.
I would look at the registration statute, where the chief of police shall issue registrations mm-hmm. for firearms, because there's specific, I think it delineates all the information you need to provide in an application.
It does.
And I feel like the purchase and registration could probably just be hand in hand.
Yeah, or even a cross-reference, maybe.
Yeah. And that way, I think that makes sense to me. Because you have to register it, so there might as well be a perfect symmetry there.
I put on the screen, there's a whole nother statute which we carried over, which is a crime. Use of false information for purchase or licensure of a firearm. It again refers to false evidence of identity, without spelling that out, and we brought that over, right? Mm. And again, that's an invitation to litigation as to like, should this ever be like? Look, I mean, honestly, again, it is very rare that this kind of statute is at issue, right? There are a lot of very narrowly tailored ones, and. But this is one, and like whatever you say about identity over there should probably be matched to the crime over here, and so right. Again, I'm wary of us. It makes sense, I think, in some places to address some of these kind of issues on civil provisions, but we're wary of getting too much into like definitional matters that.
Title VII really throws a wrench in there.
Yeah, and Title VII's its own thing. The DCMR is its own thing. Like, we've got multiple layers of stuff. And again, our goal was to really try to focus on what's actually in litigation now. So thank you for that, Dave and Kevin, for coming too. Other questions or concerns at this point? I mean, there's obviously a lot going on, but if there's something to raise with the group, or a very kind of discrete issue is...
On page 86 of the report, that's possession of a firearm by an unauthorized person. In the second degrees, you have, in addition, C is in fact subject to a court order that, because of the red flag laws and the recently enacted ERPOs, you need to add ERPO.
It's like a direct citation to ERPO.
It's not listed as 1, 2, or 3 under two.
I guess it requires
why
an
wouldn't
actor.
That
I
mean, be a court order that requires relinquishment?
And in fact, which one is, I'm sorry, which
C1. Oh,
this is
you're saying because it doesn't have
it's because it's because it's because of the
and was issued after hearing.
Yeah, if you put in.
Yeah, so let me ask
because
you.
Because it's from assaulting, harassing, or stalking, and ERPO does not address that.
Yeah, so interestingly, like under the current unlawful possession statute, it's not that obvious to me whether it was intended to just be CPOs or whether it was supposed to also include like stay away orders in criminal cases and that sort of thing. When I looked at the ERPO committee report, it looked to me like the committee had taken it as given that this provision in the existing unlawful possession statute was about CPOs, even though the language in 4503
it's not about CPOs.
Okay.
Because a mental health professional can get one against somebody who's a danger to themselves.
Okay.
Which has nothing to do with the CPOs.
I think it's more the
For
fact
example.
That there's not an or between subsections 1 and 2. So the ERPO is strictly on firearm possession and ammunition and registration certificates. So it doesn't speak to an interpersonal relationship.
I understand, but there wasn't any change made to 4503 when you guys did ERPO to make it include that. So asking that it be added is a change. That might be a change that you want me to make, but I just want to make clear that you guys didn't add that to 4503 when you.
Here's
when
the
you did ERPO,
I've got the current statute up on the screen if that's of use here. Oops, sorry. Tried that. 2, 3.
And in fact, under the ERPO ones, if you surrender it voluntarily, you can't be charged under 4503, right? It's one of the.
Is that one of the specimen ones?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So.
But that's different from being subject of an ERPO and still possessing a gun.
And the,
yeah.
So this is the
which is
well.
But.
So I guess actually.
Like yes, so if reason, you refused to, yeah.
So we
deliver.
Or let's say I get an ERPO, and they take my gun, and then I get another gun.
It's because we bifurcated it by creating a separate offense. I'm realizing it now. So we have a violation of an ERPO. That's a separate lower penalty from this because we wanted this to be a two-track system where if you're in an ERPO, it's because you're in a crisis and you're not in the generic, like, I have a gun because I'm using it for something related to criminality. So it may just be a penalty adjustment thing. That's why we didn't have it covered in 4503 here. It's because it's specifically, if you're in possession of a firearm in violation of an ERPO, the ERPO statute has a specific offense for that. So I guess it's just a question of creating a separate section for ERPOs that, I mean, to the extent that the CCRC thinks that there should be a grading penalty between the two of those.
Well, this didn't replace the ERPO statute at all. So
no, what I'm saying is that if you were, the intention is that if you're in violation of an ERPO, you would not be prosecuted under 4503, mm-hmm. you'd be prosecuted under the violation of an ERPO mm-hmm. law. Mm-hmm. But if we're creating this to be a catch-all for both of those violations, then that's why this didn't cover ERPOs, but at least the initial drafting intention on the committee side was for there to be a distinction between unlawful possession, period, and then unlawful possession due to an ERPO.
Okay.
Yeah. So,
I think we would not second guess you on the right. Like, that grading distinction would continue, so then we just need to make sure that this excludes the ERPO possibility, so that you have to, you know, like, you go down this other road, right, with the ERPO specific.
See, I would make it a three.
Because I don't know, it could be.
I'd make it a Roman numeral three. I wouldn't attach it to the one or two. Because it has different requirements.
Well, and, you know, we can look at it. You know, when we were putting this together also, this took months. and the ERPO statute still.
Yeah, it's not even codified.
Kind of complex too. It may be better to, as a standalone thing.
Either way, I just want to make sure we noted that
fair point.
That we needed to cover the ground.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Are those all moved?
Yeah. Right. That was it. There's one legal interpretation. There's one other question.
It's going to be fixing Title VII. That's the fun part.
There are statutes where the title of the
VII.
Statute is misspelled in Title VII. I think I saw at least three, and I didn't even fix those.
The fact that you have to consult two different sections of the code.
It's difficult.
Get a sense
and
of
the DCMR.
It's difficult. And again, we do not remedy
the...
There's
a historic reason for that.
We have not gone out of our way to...
Title VII is an outgrowth of the police regs.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely.
As opposed to Title 22 was the code, so it was, they started in two different origins.
And you know, I will flag this for you all, that your agency's particular views on things where there are potential issues about prosecutorial authority over some of these offenses, right? We tried to be very thoughtful about this. It's really hard, again, because the history, of course, doesn't give the case law isn't the clearest on, the extent to which changes can be made, right? And a lot depends on the history, and the DC police regs did precede, and there's this whole special, outside the home rule, preceding the home rule act, and its exclusions from, and all the litigation that resulted from that, you had this separate statutory authority for local ordinance level.
That's why Hall was decided.
Exactly,
Hall. Crawford.
Exactly. So we've got two potential, whole kinds of not hugely specific ways of interpreting prosecutorial authority based. Yeah, Hall, Crawley. These different prongs. The history itself at times has been unclear. We want to find a way to, do this. But I would just, anything your agencies can, say
part
specifically.
Part of the problem,
is,
from my analysis, is that we really need to nail down penalties for me to do a complete Crawley-Hall analysis on it because of footnotes in various Court of Appeals cases that talk about if the penalty increases to a certain amount or how the penalty is dealt with could affect their decision on it. So we may need to chime in on that, especially for guns, after the penalties have been discussed.
Sure.
And it may affect the penalties.
You bet. In footnotes, under some of these analyses, the Title 23 provision and it's kind of the whole Home Rule Act line.
23-101.
Yeah, 23-101, and it's, are you articulating this as, imprisonment and fines are both, that's the only statutory place, but we have... right, and it's the nature of the police statute, right, which, you begin to tear that apart.
Which is not defined.
Yeah. That's good to be aware of. We're not aware of any bright lines I'll speak for myself, which is correct.
You can speak for me.
We're not aware of any bright lines in the case law, such as ours, as to the effect of penalty, for instance, being a misdemeanor versus a felony on prosecutorial discretion for these types of offenses, where, again, particularly on the Hall line of cases, relying on the pre-home rule statutory authority,
I think it's an open question about the felony prosecution by my agency,
mm-hmm.
And it might very well depend on who's on the Court of Appeals on how that.
I think on out. All of this, it might well depend on the Court.
No, but that one in particular, because of different footnotes in different cases over the
have
years.
Conflicting.
Yeah, I you know, some of those. You know, if you read all of those cases.
Okay, good. Well, so we two didn't come out with a kind of clear stance on this. Again, we tried to be thoughtful about it, but I would invite, you know, in particular agencies, if you have views on that, because I think everybody wants to avoid, well, almost everybody probably wants to avoid subsequent litigation on this.
Or an inadvertent switch from the local prosecutor to the U.S. Attorney's office.
That's right, and we want to avoid certainly any...
I don't think
inadvertent
wants to do that.
And that's right.
Or do that
I will say, you know, there might be places where, you know, again, there's duplication. There's duplication by statute, right? Yeah. Like, that is the one thing that is always kind of allowed. It's often an ugly way to do things, and it's particularly ugly to the extent that it can lead to, you know, a Title VII and a Title 22 statute that are covering the exact same ground, even if we are able to recreate, you know, create them now and say they are penalties, well, do you want them to be the same? You know, it creates tensions, and then over time, one gets amended, the other, like, it just creates a whole lot of problems to create duplicate OAG USAO crimes. Mm-hmm. But that is a solution. That is a possible solution in some of these instances, where, for instance, So I'll leave it at that. I don't have anything more specific to raise, but, like, I'm sure your offices will perk up their ears when they get to prosecution, authority issues.
So, are there any other? To what extent have you, like, reviewed and sort of solidified what in Title VII you think is kind of on in your wheelhouse?
This is it for Title VII.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So we in the memo, the accompanying memo, Patrice put together this little chart here, which was just a kind of like a little multi-page
scrolls and scrolls and scrolls.
That's right. Appendix B, Advisory Group Memo 24, and basically this tries to, like, map out, right, both what we've addressed, what we haven't, where it changes over. So, you know, for Title 22, our goal is basically that we will, this is some of the terrorism statutes at the top, which are relevant and we do hope to get to. They very much, you know, all the terrorism stuff kind of sits on top of all these other offenses. They're kind of, you commit this, and you do it, you know, with a different purpose. So we hope to get to that. It'll be after this. But really, we're talking Chapter 45 of Title 22. We have addressed everything there, we believe, including some of the civil provisions, like we were talking about before, this kind of, like, using a false identity, whatever that is. We try to address all of that, including the ones that aren't really charged, and the civil provisions, although usually we were just carrying over the civil provision language as it was. In Title VII, we marked out kind of the large array of what's there. There are some that, again, we've dealt with where there seems to be, they're either charged or there's a clear, almost total overlap with a Title 22 offense. That was it. But, you know, like, you know, repeated many times is we may get to this if time permits, because there's just so much here. The DCMR, We listed a number of places, but honestly, I don't think we're confident that this this is the list, right? It's the list off of chapter 24,
right.
But 23, but stuff in the BCMR is scattered everywhere. So we try to mark that out. We try to leave the regulatory regime. Our goal was to leave the regulatory regimes untouched. Our goal was to leave the definitions largely untouched. In particularly Title VII, because like you tweak, at least in Title 22, we tweak a definition. We can say what effect it's having because we're then revising all the Title 22 offenses. Title VII, we don't want the inadvertent consequences from any changes. So there were none or virtually no changes to Title VII definitions.
Right. So we didn't change the Title VII definitions, and in some places the definitions in Title VII are not very good. So for example, the definition of firearm in Title VII includes frames and silencers, which is weird because you can't fail to holster a silencer, for example. And so, although we've retained the definition, we've adjusted then our Title VII recommendation to say, in this instance, it's not going to apply to someone who has a firearm frame, for example.
Right. So you bring in the current Title VII definitions, because we didn't want to tamper with that, and then we kind of subtract out for the particular offense, like for holstering, the parts of that definition that didn't seem applicable. That was our way of trying to narrowly tailor it. So
that way, those regulations that we didn't touch, we haven't done anything to tweak the definitions that they rely on.
For better or worse.
And so, like, for example, for Title 22, for the things that have not been changed, they'll just exist in their current format still.
So for Title 22, again, like, we think
everything
should be addressed.
25.
Yeah, so...
In the next one.
No, we've addressed everything in Chapter 45 in this set of recommendations.
What we haven't done is, like...
There's some, blackmail being done. I mean, they've done...
Chapter 45 of
Sorry.
Title 22.
Yeah, just Chapter 45. Right, there are other... Right. Yes, sorry, this is your... You're going back to more kind of base, fundamental point of, all the revised code will only apply to offenses that are revised. Right. So the other
ones remain intact unless.
That's right.
Unless you have time to address them.
That's right. Right. And blackmail, we do hope to address. soon. That was the one thing that popped to mind, right? But right, terrorism, right? Another one. There are various things. Prostitution was aside. I had a report on that recently.
We may laugh you on
in
that
a
one.
National publication. Anyway, there are a variety of them. And
I have one last question. I thought on the current law there was a penalty difference between regular ammo that you had without a permit and restricted bullets, things that like could go through Teflar jackets, then there was a penalty increase because of the more dangerousness of something that's like a hollow point or whatever the ones that go through Teflar are versus merely not having registered ammo. Mm. And I was curious why assuming I'm right in my recollection, why the penalty for those two are now the same. Or it doesn't matter if you have a 22 bullet that's unregistered, or you have something that can go through, a guy's bulletproof jacket into the guy behind him.
Mm-hmm.
So there are two different places in Title VII. So it may be helpful to pull up.
So one is
25. I think it's going to be 2507. No.
2502, or are you at?
No. I don't know why, but it was 2506.01. So, regular UA is in 2506.01 and explains. the penalty provision I want. I'm sorry. Bear with me.
So I think this is what Dave is referring
to. Yeah, that's
right.
Because they're both second degree under the new statute, but I thought in the current law, the restricted bullets were much higher penalty than a simple UA.
Okay, so 250706, if you have more than one restricted pistol bullet, then there's a huge penalty increase.
Well, what's one?
One is the same. One is even post and forfeit eligible.
Okay.
Under
a single bullet is.
Yeah, okay. A single restricted pistol bullet is under B1C.
Okay.
Is treated like self-defense spray, stun gun.
Okay.
And UF. If you have more than one restricted pistol bullet, all of a sudden it jumps up to 10 years under
A3A.
And we didn't see a clear rationale for treating two restricted pistol bullets differently from one restricted pistol bullet, but I can revisit the issue of whether a restricted pistol bullet should be treated differently than an unregistered
bullet. And I think that was the point. I talked about it with a bunch of people in my agency. I don't know how often one bullet comes up versus two, but so I can't talk to that. But with shootings the way that they are around the country now, having bullets that go through Kevlar, I think there's an argument for why the two-bullet one makes sense as a penalty. And what we were going to suggest, I think, is actually 3 degrees with the restricted bullet coming between the two.
Okay. If you do have any information on how frequently you see one or two or one versus a lot,
well, the problem, we need to speak to USAL because OAG has UA unregistered, but they have the restricted bullet. We don't do 10-year felonies.
And why is the... Okay.
It's their offense, not ours.
Even though it's Title VII?
Yes. Title VII does not distinct... Merely because it's in Title VII doesn't necessarily mean it's OAGs. But for the things that were authorized under the old police regs, they are OAGs.
So that one, we will review that. I think we misunderstood that. Understanding that, Title VII isn't necessarily, there's still nothing... I think we didn't realize that was a USAO.
There's no question that's a USAO offense, not an OAG.
And USAO is now prosecuting large capacity feeding devices since the penalty
change. Yes, that split off. Okay. That's when the council did that.
Yeah.
We conceded that became a USAO under Crawley in 23-101.
All right. Well, and we'll look at it again. Right, for restricted pistol bullets, I mean, I guess it'd be also interesting to know, is that case law-based determination as prosecutorial authority, or is that you've done your in-house review, they've done their in-house review, and this is kind of how things have proceeded, or, you know.
For large capacity feeding?
No, for restricted pistol bullets.
For the restricted bullets? I don't think anybody in either agency ever doubted that was there.
Because
we don't have any felony jurisdiction.
So it's interesting. We should have more conversation about this. Again,
certainly not a 10-year felony.
Well, it's all interesting. I would love to hear. I think as you were just saying a little bit ago, you know, while there might be bits in footnotes in some of the litigation as the penalty lines, it's a. At best, subtle art to figure that out. And again, we're not aware of any bright lines as to penalties. So to the extent that you can kind of...
Maybe we can get you some stuff. But the way the Court of Appeals, at least the way I recall it, the way that they did it, they sort of say, like, serious stuff is USAO, and the minor stuff is Corporation Counsel. Mm-hmm. When they talk about serious, they use felony in that definition. It's when some of the footnotes were things like had the fine been increased to $10,000, we're not saying that we would have kept it with corporation counsel, mm-hmm. because then the penalty mm-hmm. would have made it like more serious events.
Yeah, I can't kind of jump to this place, but I do think that, like, you know, what I do recall is from our earlier read, particularly like the In Re Hall line, right, going down a very different road. And now even with the 23-101, you know, language, the nature of the offense, and again, that is itself subject to, discussion, but that we didn't kind of see bright line criteria for that, except one being really, you know, I think in In Re Hall itself, like, if it was in historically the police regs, not only does that, it's not clear how you can get out of that box. It's not clear that, for instance, you know, by that the council could legally raise the penalty in order to change jurisdiction. And that is implied in what you're kind of saying, yeah. right? And, like, that is, I think, a real question, whether, again, merely changing penalty by doing that, either lowering or raising.
I think you have
difficult area.
My read of Court of Appeals, because, you know, who knows?
Yeah.
My read is they would have an easier time switching OAG authority to USAO because of a raise penalty than an argument that you could lower the penalty and thereby change it from a USAO offense to an OAG offense because of the home rule limitation on screwing with USAO's authority. So for whatever that's worth.
Yeah. No, complicated area.
I'm sure when this thing gets to the council, our legal counsel division is gonna opine on the effect on our jurisdiction.
Yeah. And unfortunately, I think there will be a lot of opining in a lot of corners, including ours. And ultimately, unless we can craft a solution, I would be surprised that we can do anything, frankly, that is going to survive litigation.
No, but there are ways. I mean, there are things, the way we can draft the penalty provisions that would make it more likely that it would stay an OAG offense or less likely to make it an OAG offense.
I guess what I'm wondering is where OAG is allowed to permit USAO to take over the prosecution for something.
In 23-101, we can allow them to do it as long as they are charging. We can shift jurisdiction back and forth as long as they have it, as long as one of us has an existing count.
Is there a document somewhere that says, these are the, dear U.S. Attorney's Office, these are the things that we are allowing you to prosecute, and these are the things that we are not?
Well, there's two things. One is, there is a letter in effect that was signed by both OAG and USAO that talk about charge-sharing agreement. Mm-hmm. But separate from the charge-sharing agreement can be done on a case-by-case basis. Okay. So we could deny them jurisdiction, or they could deny us jurisdiction, or we could grant them additional jurisdiction in a particular case under, I think, 23-101, like D or E, or we can even litigate the trial together.
Right. And, again, that's kind of all
the charge-sharing agreements case, change like, every 3 to 5 years, depending on.
Could I see the current one?
Probably.
Okay. Yeah. So if
I don't get it to you, shoot me an email next week.
Yeah, I just would be interested to see.
I assume it's a public document. I don't know why.
I've never seen it. I know it came up in an FTA case that USAO was prosecuting at one point, and the court ordered USAO to state to provide something showing that they were allowed to prosecute that, and then USAO dismissed the case.
Yeah,
I never saw an agreement or I've just never seen anything that explains OAG is not allowing U.S. Attorney's Office to prosecute any DUIs no matter what. I would like to see that to try to get a better handle on that.
That's not the way it's written. The way it's written is here are a list. If you have a CPWL, you can charge our UFUA. Mm-hmm. There's a listing like that.
Good.
Yeah.
Okay. Except, that'd be helpful just to get a sense of, again, kind of how this stuff both in practice, but also, you know, again, ultimately as to authority on some of this stuff.
Okay. That's it for me.
Great. Anything else at this end of the table for now? Or, again, we're happy to, you know, follow up. Yeah. Good. Good. All right. In that case, let's call it a meeting. Thank you all. Thank you, Paul. We'll,
thank you.
All right. Take care. We'll be in touch. Bye, everyone.
Bye-bye.